every time I start a book, I think this is going to be a fast one. And sometimes it does take longer. And I would say this book in part took longer because as things were literally evolving in this country, I sort of felt like I was rubbernecking my own novel and American society. So I couldn't stop looking while I was writing. And at the same time, too, I didn't want to write in reaction to what was happening. So I was peculiarly grateful for having chosen these 77 days in 2008 as a way of really looking at where we are now.
It's Shelf Life. In this episode, I talk to the author A.M. Holmes about her new novel, The Unfolding, a book which reads as an origin story for the rise of Donald Trump and the Capitol insurrection of January 6th, 2021. And we revisit a 1970 novel by Richard Yates and a short, absurdist one-act play by Edward Albee. They're two of the authors that have been influential in A.M. Holmes' own writing. More on why after this.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Amy Held. The House is expected to vote this week on legislation to force the Justice Department release of documents about convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Several Republicans are expected to defy President Trump and support the bill. Its overall odds of success are slim, but four House Republicans, including Marjorie Taylor Greene, joined Democrats, signing a petition to let the vote proceed. Trump now calls Greene a traitor. The Georgia Republican says he is stoking death threats against her. Asked on CNN about her past embrace of fiery rhetoric against others, Greene says she has changed.
I would like to say humbly, I'm sorry for taking part in the toxic politics. It's very bad for our country.
Their rift marking a fight over the future of the MAGA movement. Trump accusing Greene of lashing out because he did not support her political ambitions, which Greene denies. Trump has issued two new pardons for people in connection to the investigation into the January 6th insurrection. NPR's Eva Pukach reports.
Trump issued a second pardon for Daniel Edward Wilson. Wilson had already been pardoned for his actions on January 6, 2021, when on his first day in office, Trump granted clemency to everyone charged or convicted for the attack. But Wilson had remained behind bars due to a separate conviction for illegally possessing six guns and nearly 4,800 rounds of ammunition. After the second pardon, he was released from prison where he had been serving a five-year sentence. Trump also pardoned Suzanne Ellen Kay, who was convicted of threatening to shoot FBI agents who were investigating whether she was at the Capitol on January 6. She was released last year after serving 18 months. Eva Pukach, NPR News, Washington.
A vast majority of children in Gaza are showing signs of anxiety and aggression after more than 2 years of war. That's according to a new report by the United Nations. And despite a fragile ceasefire, daily military strikes do go on. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf reports.
The report found that more than 90% of children in Gaza exhibit aggressive behavior or violence. Sadness and withdrawal, as well as disturbed sleep, are also common. The war has led to the collapse of education, health, and social systems, and repeated displacement and trauma have broken down a sense of safety and stability. Children will require sustained long-term care to recover, the report says. Humanitarian organizations, including the UN, have stepped up efforts to address mental health services for children in Gaza, as a fragile ceasefire is holding in its second month. But there is still daily and deadly bombardment by Israel in Gaza, which Israel says is to dismantle infrastructure used by militants. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
This is NPR News. Ecuadorians grappling with a surge in violent crime vote today to decide whether to allow the U.S. to put military bases in their country. Ecuador's president says the return of foreign military bases is central to fighting organized crime. And in Chile, voters cast their ballots for a new president and Congress in a polarized general election, polls suggesting that no candidate will win outright in this first round, prompting a runoff next month between the top two candidates. John Bartlett reports from the capital, Santiago.
It feels like a long time since Chileans voted to make left-wing former student leader Gabriel Boric president in 2022. This electoral cycle has been dominated by fears over public security, illegal immigration, and international organized crime. Two far-right candidates, José Antonio Kast and Johannes Kaiser, have prospered with promises of harsh crackdowns on crime and border security. But polls show that Janet Jara, a Communist Party politician, is likely to win today's first round of voting with her promises to expand the welfare state. The two candidates with the most votes will face off in a runoff election next month, with polls suggesting that that would be a divisive showdown between a communist and an ultra-conservative. For NPR News, I'm John Bartlett in Santiago, Chile.
In Australia, a recall of coloured sand widely used by school kids has led to the temporary closure of some 70 schools. Trace amounts of asbestos were found in samples. Regulators say the risk is low. It could become airborne and be inhaled, but school is out tomorrow as inspectors work to clear classrooms. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include StoryWorth. Each week, StoryWorth emails a loved one a question about their life. After a year, StoryWorth will publish their stories and color photos into a book to keep for generations. Learn more at StoryWorth.com.
Every time I start a book, I think this is going to be a fast one. And sometimes it does take longer. And I would say this book in part took longer because as things were literally evolving in this country, I sort of felt like I was rubbernecking my own novel and American society. So I couldn't stop looking while I was writing. And at the same time, too, I didn't want to write in reaction to what was happening. So I was peculiarly grateful for having chosen these 77 days in 2008 as a way of really looking at where we are now.
Hello and welcome to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hepburn. Hello, in that esteemed group of latter-day soothsayers, we might now consider adding my guest, the writer A.M. Holmes. Holmes has just published her eighth novel, The Unfolding, a wild, trippy ride of a novel that opens on election night 2008 and closes 2 months later at the inauguration of one Barack Hussein Obama. That middle name is invoked in scorn by a group of wealthy white men who are determined to make sure that Obama is a blip in American history by covertly persuading Americans to turn back the clock. Holmes began the novel long before the 2016 election of Donald Trump, but much of it now reads more like nonfiction, an origin story of the January 6th coup, but with a novelist's curiosity and a refreshing caustic wit. She has said, "The oddity or the absurdity of everyday experience is part of what I'm capturing. My sense is that life itself can be so incredibly painful and disturbing that if one is to survive it, one has to find the humour in it." There is humour, to be sure, in Edward Albee's one-act play, An American Dream, one of the two works of fiction we'll be talking about today. A.M. Holmes' other choice is Richard Yates' 1975 novel, Disturbing the Peace, a gimlet-eyed examination of a man in extremis. A.M. Holmes, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me on, Aaron.
Let's start with your initials. I just closed my bookstore in Livingston Manor and I was driving back to Narrowsburg and trying to think of all the other novelists we know by their initials only. And I came up with quite a lot. E.B. White, A.A. Milne, E. Nesbitt, a children's author from the Victorian era who happened to be a favorite of mine growing up, G.K. Chesterton, J.K. Rowling, J.M. Barrie, the list goes on. What's the reason for authors going by their initials?
I think for me, it was about creating a space between my given name and who I am as a writer. And then the truth is, I have entirely become that name, that A.M. Holmes. And I joke, it's like, I am. And that is 100% these days who I am. I would say it's almost as though my given name is what they would now call a dead name. The other piece of it is, we were talking before we started a little bit about Andy Warhol and the way that Andy Warhol used his name a bit like a brand. And I think of A.M. Holmes as my brand.
Does it help you separate your private / personal life from your public visible life?
No, because everyone calls me A.M. and only people who think they know me and don't actually think they can call me something else. So it's always a giveaway. If you really know me, you call me A.M.
Okay, I'll keep that in mind. Now, in my introduction to you, I borrowed a quote from an interview you did in Granta magazine in 2013, when you said that we were living in a moment when reality itself was somewhat surreal. I have to ask, if 2013 was surreal, before so many of the upheavals we've since experienced, how the hell would you describe today's reality?
Terrifying. It was surreal. And I feel like in that movie where you're like, I see people, I saw bad things coming. And now I would say it's truly terrifying, because suddenly there are no limits to the length some people will go to maintain power. And I think we're seeing that all around the world. And that is super disturbing.
That obviously leads to the unfolding. It's a brilliant book, told in a very compressed time period. And I think your last novel might have taken place over the course of a year. This one, we get 2 months. I wonder if you could just start by giving us an overview. What was the spark? What was the sort of genesis of writing The Unfolding?
I think it was back in 2013 when I really felt like things were happening that weren't yet accounted for. So I felt like certainly in America, that the political establishment, not any one party or the other, but all, had lost touch with the American people, and that politics was becoming not about representation or issues or anything, but becoming about politics itself. And at the same time, there was the influx of what has now grown exponentially and what we call dark money into politics. And so for me, novels always start with what I would describe as almost like a nonfiction idea, you know, these sort of large things that I want to explore. And then add to that, in this case, I wanted to look at the scale and scope of what we think of as the great American novel, which is really known as a book by men. And somebody asked me the other day, well, why is it women don't write the great American novel? And I actually started making a list of the reasons, including that women weren't even in the workforce for a very long time or weren't allowed to work. But I wanted to write something that was along the lines of the great American novel, meaning looking at the larger socioeconomic, political picture, but also braiding that with the intimate and domestic, otherwise known as the women's novel. And I felt like I hadn't really seen that done. And so I thought, oh, you know, let's try that too.
It's primarily the story of three characters, a family that is unraveling in the wake of the 2008 election. At the center is someone we know as the big guy, who believes that democracy is imperiled by Obama's success and is willing to use a very undemocratic coup to restore a Republican to the White House. There's also the big guy's wife, Charlotte, and his daughter, Megan, who evolve during the course of this novel. Although the big guy has some pretty awful ideas, I was struck by the fact that you stand back and really let your readers judge his character.
You know, I do very much leave it to the reader. And I will say, always for me, when writing characters, and I've written some pretty complicated, dark male characters, I see my characters as human beings, and I see them as complex people. And so I actually do care about them and care for them. And even though the big guy doesn't sort of undergo the kind of awakening or coming to consciousness that Charlotte and Megan do, there is some movement there, but it's still in his own sort of oblivious, privileged bubble. You know, he begins to realize that he actually, instead of having a son as his successor, he has this daughter who's quite smart and talented and will really do something. But even when he envisions her following in his footsteps, he's still so egomaniacal that it's his footsteps. It's not her own journey.
And we have a short excerpt, AM, from the audiobook of your novel, The Unfolding. This is taken from early in the novel on the night of the 2008 presidential election, shortly after Obama has been declared the winner. Let's hear it.
A man slides into the seat next to the big guy, glances at the 4 glasses of whiskey, and signals the bartender. "Pour me one of those," he says. "Which one?" "The one in the middle." "There is no middle," the bartender says. "The Highland Park." The big guy looks up. "You can call it in the dark?" "Slanja," the man says, knocking back the drink. "You're not one of them, are you?" "One of what?" "Your hair is wet, so I'm thinking you're one of the who got sprayed with champagne and did a little victory dance a couple of hours ago." "I don't think so," the man says.
I'm more like a fella who came downstairs and took a dip in the pool in order to clear my head.
Explains the smell, the big guy says. Chlorine. The man taps his glass for the bartender.
Again.
Were you in the room upstairs?
I was.
And what did you see? The big guy asks.
A generational earthquake that split the terra firma.
The big guy snorts.
I would characterize it as a heavy metal Led Zeppelin, a grim shaking of the head, the palsied all too knowing dip of disappointment, keening women knowing they'll have crushed male egos to deal with for breakfast. The damp, dull face of defeat. They banked on the wrong horse in the absence of a better horse, while full well knowing it wasn't even a horse race, but really a rat race.
Please tell me you're not a reporter.
Historian, sometimes professor, occasional author, but not on the clock tonight.
If you're not on the clock, why are you here?
Bearing witness, the man suggests. Fellow traveler?
The big guy flags the bartender. Give him the Ardbeg. It's one of my favorites. I call it Santa's paws. Tastes like it crawled out of the fireplace. Smoky. The man laughs.
Similar to Lagavulin.
Similar. I'll tell you what I don't like, a scotch that's fruity. I don't want anything that's got raisins, cherries, or essence of fig Newton. That's what I call a stool softener. The big guy belches.
Pardon me, he says. I'm in a little deeper than I thought.
That was an excerpt, courtesy of Penguin Random House Audio, of The Unfolding by my guest, A.M. Holmes, read there by Will Damron. I was really absorbed by Charlotte's storyline in The Unfolding. She starts the novel in this quite terrifying place, increasingly aware of having squandered her life, playing this dutiful wife to the big guy, not having much of a life herself. There's a heartbreaking moment when the big guy says something to the effect of, haven't we had a great life, being inclusive, and she replies that her life hasn't even started yet. I'm curious where you find inspiration for someone like Charlotte.
I love Charlotte as well, and I would say they bear no relationship to anybody I know, which is kind of interesting. In my mind's eye, Charlotte comes a little bit out of Harold Pinter, a little bit out of Edward Albee, a little bit out of Nancy Reagan, and a little bit out of Joan Didion, and certainly out of Play It As It Lays. And I think, especially in that book, the characters are women who are struggling. They're struggling in relation to the men in their lives. They're struggling in relation to sort of their desires. And often they're taking pills or drinking too much. As much as we think women have had enormous breakthroughs in the last 30 years, I think it still has been a very difficult time. And there are many women who feel that they did not have the chance to sort of live their own lives.
Charlotte goes to rehab over Thanksgiving, and it really liberates her from the sort of submissive role she's been playing as wife to the big guy. By the novel's end, we see that she at least will have some kind of hopeful future. In your 2006 novel, This Book Will Save Your Life, one of my favorites, the protagonist, Richard Novak, undergoes a similar journey of positive transformation. I wonder, is that kind of redemption and optimism important to you?
In terms of the optimism, 100%. And what I wanted was to sort of leave the potential that there may be a chance for someone like Megan to make a difference and change the world and to sort of upend the trajectory that we're on. And at the same time, her father somehow thinks that he's going to, you know, have this daughter who does his bidding going forward. And I think that's the toggle right at the end that I wanted to sort of play with, because we don't quite know what she'll do.
One of the great pleasures of this book, AM, is that we get to encounter some real life figures, including Obama and George W. Bush. William Barr, Bill Barr, is in this book. How much fun was it for you to create dialogue for living historical figures like that?
So much fun. Because importantly, too, whenever I was using a real figure, it was important to me that the way I use them be in some way sort of historically accurate. So there's a scene where Megan and the big guy go to visit George Bush just before he's about to leave the White House. And I wanted to really capture that in the sense of, like, what is he looking forward to? some people would say, you know, starting their library, that's a big presidential thing or different things. You know, he's looking forward to painting, which we all know that he did. And then even things like these weird references to the M&Ms, there are these very specific presidential M&Ms, and each new president, they reissue them with that president's signature on it. It used to be jelly beans under Reagan, and before that, it was cigarettes that they gave out on Air Force One. And so when people stopped being able to smoke on planes, all of a sudden they had to change from the cigarettes to the jelly beans. And then after Reagan, everyone's like, we're not giving out jelly beans anymore.
I have to say, I'm definitely more of a jelly beans guy than I am an M&M's guy.
I'm an M&M's, and I actually have the belief that the newer blue M&M is an antidepressant.
Isn't all chocolate supposed to be an antidepressant?
No, the red ones and the brown ones make you kind of hostile and angry, and the light blue ones are really an antidepressant.
Okay, no more red M&Ms for me. I'll definitely avoid them going forward. I got to ask, okay, visited the White House yourself. Were you invited to one of Obama's parties?
I was not invited to one of Obama's parties. I so wish I had been. I would love to go. I'm available. I'm open to ideas. I did visit the White House because I grew up in Washington. When Nixon was welcoming George Pompidou, we would go, our whole school or class would go, and we'd be doing cartwheels on the lawn while Nixon was speaking and so on. And because my family grew up there, you know, I have all this footage too of my uncle and my mother that one of my grand uncles took of them walking right up to the front door of the White House because there didn't used to be a gate. There certainly were no barricades. And so there's all this funny footage of them sort of walking up and pretending to knock on the door and stuff. You know, Washington was, and I suspect still is, but certainly when I was growing up, it was still a small southern town that was very dysfunctional.
How did you end up growing up there? I know your father was an artist, was a painter. Your mother was a stay-at-home mom for much of the time and then went into counseling. Why was D.C. the city they chose to make their home?
Their parents had come there. So my father's parents had come there as peddlers escaping Russia, you know, Jews escaping Russia, like in 1912, somewhere around there. And my grandmother's family had come from Latvia and they were dairy farmers in North Adams, Massachusetts. And my grandmother ultimately moved to Washington to get a job, maybe during World War I with like the Treasury Department or something. And then she ultimately brought all of her family down from the farm to live in Washington. We were the rare, weird thing, which is a Washington native. And there aren't very many of those.
In your 2007 memoir, The Mistress's Daughter, you write very movingly of the experience of being adopted and of the sense of being in some ways a replacement for your adoptive mother's son, who had died at the age of 9, just 6 months before you were born. In what ways do you think that experience shaped your consciousness as a writer?
I think it shaped me, of course, enormously, and in different ways. I would say one of the things that probably really shaped me a lot was that my adoptive parents were, as much as they were dark and grief-stricken, and there was sort of this cloud hanging over the house, they were people who loved theater, who loved poetry. And so I was exposed all of my life to art, to theater, to poetry, and so on, but to the darkest versions of it, because that's what they were drawn to, too. But I also think that the experience of being adopted and being other in one's own home definitely made me somebody who saw the world differently and was sort of very much an observer of the world and didn't see myself in the world in some ways. And funny enough, you know, later we're going to talk about Edward Albee, but Edward Albee was also adopted in Washington, D.C., and he and I used to talk about that because I think it definitely affects a person rather profound.
I wonder if you can just stay with that thought. Perhaps tell me a little more what you mean by that.
I would say, you know, one of the ways I try to describe it to people is along the lines of saying that, say you were born as Abe Lincoln, but then somebody raises you and your name is George Washington. And so you're actually living a different life and living a different biological, economic, socio-cultural experience than the one you carry with you in your DNA. So it's pretty profound. And I would say, I think that often, you know, they talk about, oh, adopted people have higher rates of learning disabilities. Adopted people have higher rates of all these kinds of problems. And I think part of that really is about integration of identity, of senses, of experience, that without acknowledging that one's identity has been disintegrated, literally, it's a real thing. So I think when I was a kid, not even a kid, an adult, someone once said to me, do you think all adopted people are like you, or is it just you? I said, well, I don't know, but I don't think it's just me. Certainly in the 1960s, something that was not really talked about, one of the big things too, was that families tried to pretend they hadn't adopted the child. So you were supposed to just blend in. Obviously, when people adopted a child of a different race or from another country, it would be harder to kind of fake that. And I always secretly admired kids who didn't look like their family members. I have two Black adopted cousins. And when we were kids, we were sitting, you know, my aunt's house upstairs. And I said to them, you know, I'm adopted too. And they're like, no, you're not. I was like, yes, I am. And I remember yelling downstairs, Mom, am I adopted? Tell them I'm adopted. You know, because they were like, you look just like all the other people downstairs. So it's complicated.
You're listening to Shelf Life with me, Aaron Hicklin. My guest is A.M. Holmes, the author of seven novels, several short story collections, and a memoir, The Mistress's Daughter, in which she writes about her experiences as an adopted child. A.M., when you were 31, your biological or birth mother contacted you and you began to meet. One of the devastating observations you make after an early encounter is that if you'd grown up with her, it would have destroyed you. I wonder if you can share what prompted that thought.
Yes, absolutely. So I think the reason I wouldn't have survived was I think my biological mother barely had the skills to take care of herself, much less the skills to take care of another person. Her own life had been, I would say, complex, traumatic, and more. I mean, it is very odd to be a 31-year-old and have somebody show up and say, I'm your parent. And I think in some ways try to get back the life that she had sort of abandoned of her own, and thinking that somehow by finding me that would happen. And that's, you know, just a very deluded kind of point of view. So complicated.
Yeah, I think at one point she turns around to you and asks or says, wouldn't it be wonderful if you could adopt me? Which is a very bizarre thing to hear your birth mother say to the daughter that was adopted.
Yeah, but it speaks to the kind of pain I think she was in. And, you know, in retrospect, I wished I could have sort of dealt with her differently. But at the time, I would say I found the whole thing terrifying. It so undid my sense of self that it took me months to just even feel like right anymore. You know, all of a sudden, you're not who you thought you were, but you don't know who you are.
Mm. Now, we're not going to talk about specifics because I don't want to give the book away for anyone who hasn't read it yet. But some of that experience has clearly found its way into the unfolding. How does that kind of alchemy work for you, taking parts of your life and inserting them or finding ways to synthesize them into a fiction?
So I would say I don't do it that often on this scale, because this is really like I did live something that is notably from my life and apply it in a very different form, but to the book quite clearly. But I would say I wanted to explore it, and I wanted to look at it a little bit from the point of view of Charlotte, of this woman who has a very different experience of all this, and also what it might mean to Megan when she does find out more about her own origin story. There's always things that one puts in the books that are true to one's life. But as my mother would say, she'll say things like, I recognize that sandwich, or I know what thing you're talking about there. It'll be like a location or a person or something. But they're small, and they are things that I would say give me great pleasure. But in this case, it was the desire to kind of turn that adoption experience somewhat sideways and sort of look at it differently.
Mm.
And I think importantly, we're living at such a time where questions about identity are very, very big, and who gets to claim certain identities. And I will say that as an adopted person, I don't even know what identity one claims, because you are all of these people simultaneously. And so I think that for me was an interesting also thread to put into the mix.
In the unfolding, one of the characters that orbits around the big guy and his wife and daughter is a gay Washington insider called Tony, who has spent his career in the closet, or at least the glass closet, since it seems that most people are aware that he's gay. He even goes to parties with his black boyfriend. You cram some great detail on the history of gay men, in particular in government. What was that research that you had to do, or did that come from people you already knew in that world?
You know, that's a good question. It's a real combination. So I'd say, writing this book, I knew I loved history, but it made me more interested in all things. And I had read long ago that JFK's best friend was a guy named Lem Billings, and he went everywhere with JFK. He had been, I think, his roommate either in high school or college or both, who was gay, but who wasn't out. And then Franklin Roosevelt also had a gay man very high up in his administration, and there was Joseph Alsop, the columnist. And it's interesting, I mostly know about it in terms of gay men in politics. And part of it was, certainly years ago, they didn't have families, they weren't married, so they could work round the clock for whatever person they were supporting. And there were various velvet scares and times that the government turned on the gay people in government and so on. And I also remember very vividly growing up in D.C., being aware that there were these closeted gay men and that their life was complicated and sometimes really kind of sad. And then the AIDS crisis happened, and numerous of these gay men died, and they died without their families knowing what was happening. They died in kind of awful ways. And I did know a guy when I was a kid growing up who was sort of one of my entree points to gay life in Washington. And he was a guy who'd come up from the South who supported his mother and sisters, and he ultimately died of AIDS. And so for me, Tony was a little bit of a wanting to acknowledge that. And then strangely, like 2 months ago, a great book called Secret Cities came out that's all about gay Washington. Mm. It's very, very interesting to read. And I also was curious how, having lived through the AIDS epidemic, how that would change a character like Tony and how it would begin to make him perhaps see the world or his own agenda slightly differently.
There's a short scene in the book when Megan, the daughter of the big guy, who is busy figuring out her own identity, explains to a taxi driver that she just voted for John McCain. Asked why, she replies that McCain believes what we believe, that this should be a good country, a strong country, that we should all work hard. In one sense, I thought that was just the kind of meaningless platitude you hear on either side of the political aisle. But it's also a reminder that beneath the partisanship, what most people want is pretty elemental: security, opportunity, a good life. Do you think this is a country that can find common ground again?
I would certainly say it is a personal goal of mine, and I think it would be amazing if we could. I am increasingly worried because I think there's something happening where words like democracy mean different things to different people. And in fact, one of my editors in another country called and said, I'm confused because the big guy keeps talking about how much he wants to preserve and protect democracy, and yet he's seeming to sort of do things that would, you know, overthrow the government. And I said, yes, because his version of democracy is different than someone else's. Hmm. And I think we are really at a moment where words that we thought we knew what they meant mean different things. You know, Kellyanne Conway coined it, alternative facts, or narratives. I can't even call them, you know, news. I mean, there are narratives that people are investing in and listening to and believing that are so far from accurate. And I think that's what happened on January 6th. So I'm scared, and I would like to feel otherwise.
You're listening to Shelf Life. My guest today is the novelist A.M. Holmes. We'll be back after this.
The Radio Catskill Music Auction is live online. Bid now on vintage stereo equipment like turntables by Bang & Olufsen, Yamaha and Duel, a Denon stereo receiver, cassette decks from Kenwood and Harman Kardon, classic items tested, working, and ready to play your music. Don't miss your chance to get your hands on all of our incredible items and experiences. Bid on the Radio Catskill Music Auction now at WJFFradio.org.
You're listening to Shelf Life. My guest today is the novelist A.M. Holmes. A.M., we're ready to talk about some of your book choices, but I wonder if you could just give us a little bit of an insight to your sort of reading habits as a child. Were you a voracious reader growing up in D.C.?
I think so. Yes, I remember very distinctly practicing my signature because you had to be able to sign your name to get a library card. And then, you know, I was always the person who took like 13 books at a time out of the library and fairly early on had to get special permission to go into the adult section, which to me, the word adult section meant the same as like pornography. And I think, you know, then I started reading things like Michael Crichton, The Terminal Man and The Andromeda Strain. And then at a certain point, when I was able to drive, there was a thing called the Maryland Book Exchange that was out by University of Maryland. And they had these New Directions paperbacks and all of these sort of small press books. So all of a sudden there are the Beats and there's Henry Miller and Burroughs. And I'm just, you know, rolling in a whole other world. So there's that. And then there was a whole like Hemingway and all that phase, you know, Paris Review interviews. I loved all of it.
From the Beats and Hemingway to another great American writer, Richard Yates, author of Revolutionary Road, Cold Spring Harbor, and your first book choice, Disturbing the Peace. A.M., this novel opens with a barn burner of a sentence. Everything began to go wrong for Janice Wilder in the late summer of 1960. If that doesn't make someone want to read on, I'm not sure what will. But the novel then does a quick about turn from Janice Wilder to her husband, who ends up committed in Bellevue, comes out, has a series of affairs, drinks extravagantly, has schizophrenic episodes, and ends up in a full-on mental collapse. Why did you choose this book as among your favorites?
I think the book is brilliant. And I think it's brilliant for how, in some ways, raw it is, how vulnerable and exposing. And it's just devastating. I mean, it is emotionally and physically devastating. And I think, you know, I'd always admired Richard Yates and loved Revolutionary Road, which is equally pretty devastating. And 11 Kinds of Loneliness, the short stories are heartbreaking, and Easter Parade. But this one to me feels it's the most about Richard Yates himself. And it's just a man's guts on the table. And it's beautiful and horrible, horrible, excruciating in the best of ways. And it feels, you know, there's a kind of, I would say, truth or accuracy to it, where I feel like so often in fiction and theater, there's a lot of artifice and a lot of hiding behind things. And this feels to me like the exact opposite. There's nothing he can hide behind here.
Right. As you say, it's extremely raw. Richard Yates wrote 7 novels. He was highly regarded in his lifetime. But by the end of the 20th century, his books were no longer in print. There are, of course, other writers who have suffered that fate. It was only thanks to Revolutionary Road, I think, being turned into a successful movie in 2008 with Leonardo DiCaprio and Kate Winslet, that his books came back into print. Is that an elemental fear for a writer, that their literary legacy will be forgotten after their death?
I'd like to say that until you mentioned it, I hadn't really thought about it, Aaron. I think it is terrifying when a writer's books go out of print. And I think with Yates, in part, his own mental health and his own behavior, you know, contributed to that in some ways. And that's also sort of a complicated cautionary tale. But I remember years ago, I used to live on Christopher Street, and there was a photograph in a book about Dawn Powell. And I remember looking at the photograph, feeling like it was the view from my building. And it said that when she died, all of her books were out of print. And I was just like, oh my God, like, what is this? I think that absolutely for a writer, that is a horrible fear, because we sit in these rooms locked in for years. And I think there is absolutely some fantasy or hope that, you know, our work will outlast us, or that we're doing something that is, you know, meaningful or profound, or will, I don't know, have some effect on society. And yet, as we see year after year, you know, the numbers in publishing are not good. And you look and you see Hemingway got paid $5,000 to publish a story in whatever, like 1935. That's still a lot to get paid. And that's really scary.
One of the things that strikes me reading Disturbing the Peace is that this kind of book, themed around a kind of middle-class alienation, a kind of existential malaise, was a real staple in the 60s and 70s. I'm thinking of John Updike's Rabbit Run series, for example. But it's really fallen out of fashion. Why do you think that happened?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I think upper middle-class, you know, navel-gazing is probably not what it once was. I mean, the other themes in Yeats and in Updike and Cheever are really also about success, about a sense of competition, about failure. John Cheever was obsessed with, you know, the idea of aging and somehow no longer being, you know, virile and masculine and so on. So I think those themes are still in the work that we are sort of writing and reading, but are expressed differently. It happened weirdly last night when I was looking up this book. I found a piece by Alice Walker talking about liking Richard Yates's work. And I thought that is so cool, because if you look at the characters in the Richard Yates, you know, these are bloated old white men. I mean, in some ways you could be like, they're not that interesting, but she appreciated in a way the bluntness and the sort of horrific clarity with which he paints this picture.
Mm. A.M., I wonder if you see parallels between your novel, The Unfolding, and this book choice of yours, Disturbing the Peace, perhaps between the big guy and Yeats's protagonist, John Wilder.
You know, what I find interesting is, to me, the big guy is having more of like an existential crisis about what does it mean to be an older white man? What does it mean to fear losing power? What does it mean to feel that you've not created enough of a mark? I see that as different. I see Orange Jesus, otherwise known as Donald Trump, as probably much more like John Wilder, because I think that when I look at Donald Trump, there seems to be more kind of a mental illness going on. I feel like the big guy and his sort of cohort, the Forever Men, are more, they're not insane. Do you know what I mean? And that's also what makes them so scary and so powerful.
Yeah. One of the other parallels for me was the sheer economy of language. Yeats just never lingers very long in any one place. Scenes don't overstay their welcome. Is that something that comes to you as a writer through revision, or is that brevity just there at the very beginning?
I think it comes to me both ways. I mean, it comes to me definitely through revision because I cut a lot, but it also comes to me because I think my orientation was first to theater, and it was towards Albee and Pinter and, you know, in some ways Yeats and Cheever and so on. And so I'm more interested in letting the characters sort of speak for themselves. And it's funny, even when I write for TV or film, they always come back to me like, could you describe this a little bit more? You're not giving us much description here. And I'm like, oh, you know, that costs extra. I just want to see people talking and engaging in those ways. So, yeah.
One of the offstage characters who looms in the background of Disturbing the Peace is John F. Kennedy. When the book opens, Kennedy is running for president. And then partway through, we experience his assassination secondhand through John Wilder. And his reaction is not typical, is it? He feels sympathy for the assassin. He understands the motives, he says. Kennedy has been too rich, too young, too handsome, and too lucky. That seemed to me almost a kind of foreshadowing. I mean, making a big leap, but of the kind of men who stormed the Capitol on January the 6th. Hatred and resentment of people who are doing better than you. What did you make of that scene?
I think, you know, in Richard Yates's work, and especially in Disturbing the Peace, there's an incredible amount of anger and bitterness and resentment. And it's almost the thing, it's like a poison, you know, to the character, because it is the thing that takes him out as much as his drinking. And it is the thing that makes him also socially really unacceptable, because the way that he has these outbursts and says these things that are dark. And I 100% think that among people who follow the directions to come to the Capitol and storm the building, there is an enormous feeling of anger and disappointment and fear and sense that somehow they were cheated out of the American dream, that what they forgot the meaning of the word dream, and they thought it was the word promise or entitlement, that all people would have, you know, the house, the cars, the boat. Mm-hmm. And instead they've got a trailer, no job, and food stamps. And I think that is very, very painful. And it's easier in some ways to rage against the government, the machine, whatever you want to call it, than figure out how to take responsibility for one's own existence, which is complicated.
Mm. At the same time, this is a wickedly funny send-up of Hollywood. John Wilder ends up going there for an extended period of the novel. He's trying to pitch a movie about his mental breakdown. He gets to meet all these ridiculous directors and producers, sort of pitching a version of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. It seems a very knowing critique of Hollywood, drawn, I suspect, from Yates's own experience.
I think he did spend some time there in that way that, you know, often successful novelists, especially during that time period, were summoned, whether it be Faulkner or, you know, Richard Yates or so on. Nabokov actually went and did some screenwriting. I think it's incredibly painfully accurate. And it's just, it's, I mean, in the best of ways, excruciating, because it is really true, and it represents and skewers that process and that system.
People may not know this, but you go well beyond novel writing and short stories. You've written scripts, I think, for The L Word, for your own novel, Jack, and for various other TV pilots. Did you ever consider making screenwriting your mainstay?
No, absolutely not. But, you know, when you write for TV and film, you get health insurance, which we don't otherwise get in this country. And you also get a pension later. So it's all great. I will say, on the one hand, there are things about it I like and I find it fun. And it's also collaborative, which obviously writing a novel is not. But in the end, you don't own the thing you wrote. And you can't take it somewhere else when they, you know, without any further ado, just kill it and say, we're not doing this. And so I always used to say, God, if this was my only job, I would be so depressed. Because when you get to come back and write fiction and it's really all yours and you can play and go off on, you know, tangents in fun ways and good ways, it is wonderful. So I would say I like the camaraderie of working on things together. I mean, once you're in a production of a TV show, you feel like you may as well be like a war medic because it gets that intense, you know, and there's so much at stake until you step back and realize that we're talking about lunch. I mean, it's not really that much at stake, but everyone acts like it is, you know, it's all an emergency. And so there's that adrenaline and peculiarity, but it's pretty wild and out there.
It's striking that you've chosen a book that is centered on one man's life, because so many of your own novels have a similar interest in the anxieties of men. Not just The Unfolding, but also your earlier novel, This Book Will Save Your Life, and your debut, Jack, among others. You obviously like men as a subject. What's the draw?
I am a man. I mean, it's kind of, it's both as simple and complicated as that. I will say I really do love men. I'm fascinated by them. I'm fascinated by the ways in which I am different and they are different from me. I find in some ways female characters harder to write. And I often think it's because that is an experience that I'm living. And I don't know. I mean, I think also, if I was being honest, I would say I look back at having grown up in the shadow of this ghost of the dead brother who's 10 years older than I am. And I think that that boy absolutely inhabits my work. And it's not a mystery to me that I'm often writing men who are probably about 10 years older than I am.
Why is it that women seem to be able to write men well, but men rarely seem to write women well?
I think that in some ways, without seeming to be critical of men, men don't realize sort of the space they occupy, the way they move through the world, their own incredible privilege, because they haven't had to sort of see it in some ways. And so I think women sort of see more. And in some ways, when men write women, they're writing it still from a male eye and from that experience, as opposed to really trying to sort of inhabit the way a woman sees the world, I think. And I don't know that that's the best description, but that's a description.
You're listening to Shelf Life. My guest today is the novelist A.M. Holmes. We've been talking about Disturbing the Peace by Richard Yates. A.M., it's time to talk about your second book choice, The American Dream. This is a one-act play by the late, great American dramatist Edward Albee, a play that has been described as the first truly American absurdist play in that tradition of European playwrights like Eugene Ionesco. Albee is better known for his big hitters like Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and Zoo Story. This is early Albee. It features five characters who we know only as Mommy, Daddy, Grandma, Mrs. Barker, and Young Man. It has no real beginning, no middle, no end, and much of the dialogue seems, frankly, nonsensical. When did you first encounter it?
You know, I can't even remember. And it's funny because when I told you, oh, I want to talk about this play, I remembered it so differently. And I think in some ways I've sort of made a mashup of his plays in my mind. But I would say as a late adolescent young adult, I encountered Edward and then I became friends with him. So we were friends. He was incredibly helpful to me early on in my life. And it's interesting. At some point I want to write something called These Are My Fathers that is really about the impact of influence. And it would be about, for me, it would be about obviously Yeats and Cheever and Edward Albee and Harold Pinter. But in a more literal sense, I met Edward out on Long Island. I don't even know how old I was. It was probably like about somewhere between 1985 and 1989. And then at a dinner party that I happened to be invited to. And of course, I was in awe of him. And then a few years later, I went to the writer's residency he had on Long Island in Montauk called The Barn. That really was this old rundown barn. And it was the first thing he bought when he had some success as a writer. And he used it as a place to invite other writers and artists to come and do their work. And he would bring the mail every day. And it was just amazing. And then I went there again later. And I remember Edward at one point said to me something, "You're a literary terrorist." And I think it was when End of Alice came out. But I took that as an incredible sort of compliment. I would say his work and Yeats's work made my work possible. They take a lot of emotional risk. They're both, I would say, in some ways experimental. This play, I didn't even realize until I reread it now how much about adoption it is. And also, in part, I would say a little bit about being gay when they talk about this adopted child touching himself in ways where they literally say, well, then cut off his hands. I mean, you know, that's pretty intense. And I think that was something that Edward absolutely struggled with in his adoptive family.
Did you see that in it when you first read it? Did you understand it immediately?
I don't think so. And I think what's kind of fascinating is there are other things I can look at, too, that I read as a kid. And I didn't understand how much they meant in terms of my own personal story. I remember reading about, you know, Eleanor Roosevelt and Babe Ruth, and I just loved both of them. And it turned out later they were both people who had been sent away from their families at some point. Eleanor Roosevelt was sent to live with these weird aunts in England, and Babe Ruth was sent to an orphanage when his mother died. And really, I identified with that piece of isolation and alienation. And I think with Edward, there's that part, but he's also really angry, really bitter, and funny slash hostile. And I think that part I always have loved about him. He is just biting and can be really bitchy. And I admire that.
You said that Albee described you as a literary terrorist, something of an accolade in his eyes. That was in the wake of your book, The End of Alice, which caused a huge stir at the time. The main character is a paedophile in jail who strikes up a correspondence with a 19-year-old girl who plans to seduce a 12-year-old neighborhood boy. Not all the responses were harsh, but many were. How did you respond to that at the time?
I mean, I think it's interesting. So, you know, when I look at a book like The End of Alice, and it's a very difficult story, and it was really written in part to talk about morality and sexuality and how we, not just in this country, but around the world, do such a bad job dealing with sex abuse. And the pedophile says, you know, if I'm in jail, why is this still happening? Which basically points the finger at the reader or us. And so it is a super challenging book. I firmly believe there's such a thing that I would call the good-bad review, which is the very well-informed and smart person who may have a negative reaction to something, and that's okay. You know, when people come up to me and they say, I love The End of Alice, I'm like, ooh, because it's not written as a book that one is meant to love. It is written as a book that one is meant to read part of, hurl it across the room, and then kind of have to go pick it up again and keep reading. It is a challenge. And it was certainly the hardest thing I've ever written and the most complicated. But, you know, that's okay. It's actually now used to teach psychiatrists how to deal with pedophiles. And that's okay with me, too.
Your very first novel, Jack, was a coming-of-age story in which a teenager has to deal with his father coming out. That was published in 1989 when you were 28. But you wrote it when you were 19. It's since become one of the most frequently banned or challenged books at schools and public libraries. I should add, it's in very good company. Judy Blume, J.D. Salinger, Alice Walker, the list goes on. But how seriously do you think we should be taking literary censorship in our schools?
I wrote it as homework in a class because they said, you know, you have to write a paper. And I said, can I write a novel instead? And the professor said, what makes you think you can? And I didn't want to say, because I know I can't write the paper. So yes, I was a child. And I really structured the book to look at bias and homophobia. And I purposely made the main character this boy who is dealing with his father's coming out, because I wanted to show it from the point of view of somebody who is taken aback and surprised and has to reconcile his own complicated feelings about it. I guess I very strongly feel that, you know, we read to find ourselves, we read to inhabit experiences other than our own, and that censoring books or telling children what they can and can't read is very, very dangerous. I don't think literature in and of itself is dangerous. I don't think anybody reading a book about a kid whose dad is gay is going to be injured in some way. So I'm really worried about where we are in terms of that kind of thing.
Back to Edward Albee and the American Dream. I have to ask what it is that you find in a play like the American Dream, as opposed to novels, that has shaped and informed your own instincts.
It's interesting because I think when I go back and look at this, there is definitely a play of intellectual life and of ideas and of thorny juxtapositions, I would say, in some ways. And what's interesting to me about plays is that because you have an actor on stage, the audience will go further and tolerate more, let's say, confusion, dissent, absurdity than perhaps one might tolerate in a novel. And he is feisty. He is always poking the bear, as they would say. And I think his renderings of marriage, of family are just stunningly brilliant. You know, in the play, A Delicate Balance, there's a moment where the neighbors come over and I think move in with the main couple, and they just say they're afraid, but it's not even clear exactly what they're afraid of. And I would say, I'm afraid, and I would like to move in with Edward Albee. I think he gets at a lot of the subconscious and the stuff that is just beneath the surface, which is very much what I'm interested in as well. The things that we don't necessarily have language or description for, he manages to kind of bring them to the surface without naming them, you know, too heavily. I don't know. I think that Albee is just really profound and funny. He's funny in a way that no one talks about him being funny, but he's really funny.
A.M. Holmes, this has been a really delightful conversation. Thank you.
Such a treat being with you.
We've been talking about Disturbing the Peace by Richard Yates, published by Delta, and The American Dream by Edward Albee in The Collected Plays of Edward Albee, Volume 1, 1958 to 1965, published by Overlook, Duckworth. The Unfolding by A.M. Holmes is published by Viking. My thanks, as always, to my producer, Ilya Maritz, and sound engineer and composer, Tim Wood. Shelf Life is a production of Grand Journal in association with WJFF Radio Catskill. And if you like the show, you can find plenty more on Apple and Spotify, with guests such as Alan Cumming, John Waters, Joyce Maynard, and Jonathan Escoffrey. While you're there, consider giving us a great review and a 5-star rating. It helps others find our show.
Hey there, I'm Jason Dole, letting you know that we are now just 2 weeks away from our big annual music sale happening at the Liberty Mall, November 29th. Mark your calendar now, set an alarm, tell a friend. It's 10 to 3 the Saturday after Thanksgiving. Thousands of vinyl records, CDs, cassettes, and 45s. We also have tons of used vintage audio equipment, musical instruments, and more. And yes, we are still taking donations. And here's the breaking news for you. Old School Sessions will be DJing live at the music sale. Selector Starkey, DJ Chuck, spinning live, celebrating 25 years of Old School Sessions right here on Radio Catskill. So it's not just a sale, it's now a happening. You need to be there. And if you can't wait two more weeks, well, I've got something for you too, because Radio Catskill's online music auction is happening right now. With a selection of rare vinyl, vintage record players, tickets to big events, and more, go to WJFFradio.org to bid now and bring your friends to the music sale November 29th. This is Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, this is Radio Catskill. Local news, culture, and NPR.